We are joined here live in the studios once again by Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
To you both.
Good afternoon.
Whoop. Oh, whatever. Better turn on Job's mic there.
Good afternoon.
There we go.
There he is. Nice to have
you back.
We
moved him to a different
Thank
mic.
You. Nice to be back.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So we're assuming you've been in warm-up practice mode for the last 4 weeks.
Pretty much, yeah.
Good.
Belting it out in the shower.
Well, and also, riveted to the impeachment proceedings because I don't have a life.
My condolences there.
Thank you.
We're hoping we can make some good use of that later.
That's good because I have a little too much of a life, so I don't have time to watch the impeachment hearings. So.
Yep. Well, when you're laid up in bed for weeks, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
there's the internet.
That's your form of entertainment.
One of them.
All right. Still plenty to cover. Let's start with the developments this week regarding the Regional Homelessness Authority.
Yeah. Last week, the King County Regional Policy Committee approved an amended plan for the new Regional Homelessness Authority. And this Wednesday, the King County Council voted 8-1 to approve the new plan. The only no vote was Dave Up the Grove. He represents South King County, and he opposes the county council giving up control of the $57 million in funding for homelessness that the King County Council has in the past year used to fund their homelessness programs. Now, this week, the Seattle City Council debated the amended plan, and on Thursday, they voted it out of committee with no changes. The full council will vote on it this coming Monday. In addition to the amended plan, the City Council Select Committee on Homelessness and Housing Affordability voted to include a new city ordinance along with the amended plan instead of amending the plan yet again, which would have sent it back to the Regional Policy Committee to debate, maybe make more changes and vote on it again, and then it'd have to come back to the City Council and the County Council, et cetera. So the question is, instead of changing the plan, the City Council added an ordinance. What's in the ordinance is the question, right? Now, some City Council members, particularly Lorena Gonzalez and Lisa Herbold, were concerned that the amended Regional Homelessness Authority plan would give smaller, more conservative cities in King County too much influence in the agency, when Seattle will be providing 57% of the funding. That's about $73 million. And King County will be providing the other 43%, or $57 million. The agency will not have the power to levy any new taxes either, so those smaller cities will never be required to contribute funding in the future. Each city each of these small cities who decide to join the Regional Homelessness Authority will be able to create their own sub-regional plan, which means that smaller cities could require the agency to implement policies that are punitive to homeless people instead of being based on evidence-based strategies and be inclusive. Now, the separate sub-regional plans could also lead to a highly fragmented approach instead of the unified approach that is supposed to be the main reason for moving to a regional homelessness authority, instead of having everybody continue to do their own thing. In addition, the governing committee will be dominated by elected officials instead of homelessness experts and people with lived experience of homelessness. And this could lead to political solutions as opposed to the evidence-based solutions that have been proven to work. So the new city...
And political solutions such as what Seattle has been pursuing for years.
Yeah. So the new city council... the new city ordinance that was proposed in the committee at the city council basically says that the city council hopes the new regional homelessness authority will adhere to evidence-based strategies, that the implementation board, that's the day-to-day leadership of the new regional agency, will represent the demographics of the homelessness population that the agency will serve, and that the agency will make an annual report to the city council and the King County Council on their progress and their policies. Now, the ordinance is non-binding on the regional homelessness authority.
Did it actually say hopes in the ordinance?
Well,
like we hope they'll do something?
Yeah, well, yeah. So here's the deal. The new city council ordinance is non-binding on the Regional Homelessness Authority. It only is binding on the city of Seattle because it's a city of Seattle law. It's not a King County law. It's not a state law, et cetera. But it does contain an enforcement mechanism. It says that the Seattle City Council can withhold funding for the regional agency if it fails to meet the requirements of the ordinance. So that's where the city council, you know, they can say, we hope you do this, we want you to do this, we want you to do that. And if you don't, we may withhold funding. We may vote at any time through the budget process to withhold funding. Now, the council members who voted for both the Regional Homelessness Authority plan and to move the ordinance forward are the committee chair, Sally Bagshaw, Bruce Harrell, Deborah Juarez, Mike O'Brien, and Alex Peterson. Lorena Gonzalez was also at that meeting. She abstained, saying that she wanted to hear back from the King County Council and the Sound Cities Association, which represents these smaller cities in King County, that they would agree to follow the terms of the new ordinance before she's willing to vote for it. Three committee members were absent: Lisa Herbold, Teresa Mosqueda, and Shama Sawant. So now both the plan and the ordinance are likely to pass the city council on Monday because five committee members voted for it and are not likely to change their votes in the general council meeting. So the Regional Homelessness Authority will be able to move ahead with the start of the new year, but it's going to take a while to form the governing board, the implementation board, and to hire a CEO, which will be one of the first tasks of the governing board. And I know Mike asked the question last week, who selects the members of the governing board? The members come from four different blocks. The members of the three blocks get to choose their members. So the Seattle City Council will choose two of its own council members plus the mayor to form one block of the 12 members on the governing board. The county council will choose two of its own members plus the King County executive to form their block on the regional governing board. The Sound Cities Association, which, as I said, represents the smaller cities in King County, they'll choose three of their members to sit on the regional authority governing board. And then the final three members are members with lived experience of homelessness. They're going to be chosen by the advisory committee. Now, the advisory committee will be chosen by the implementation board. That's the group of experts who will run the agency day to day.
Define expert.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now, who gets...
I would think the people with lived experience of homelessness would be the experts.
Would be the experts. Mm. But the regional plan actually does define who the experts are. And you can go and read the requirements there. And there's a long list of requirements. Now, who chooses the members of the implementation board, which will run the day-to-day operations of the Regional Homelessness Authority? It will have 13 members. They'll be chosen as follows. Two will be appointed by the Seattle mayor, Jenny Durkin. Two will be appointed by the Seattle City Council. Two will be appointed by the King County Executive, Dow Constantine. Two will be appointed by the King County Council. Two will be appointed by the Sound Cities Association. And the final three members representing folks with lived experience of homelessness will be appointed by the advisory committee. So there's a little bit of a circular
The composition of all of those is not very confidence inspiring.
No, it isn't. And it doesn't really do what Lorena Gonzalez and Lisa Herbold had said they want, that and that the advisory group that recommended going to a regional homelessness authority had recommended, that you try to remove the selection of the experts, you try to remove the influence of political candidates from the process in order to try to get the best evidence-based strategies for the region and a unified approach. This seems to be breaking down now in the approval process for the plan.
I haven't known a lot of elected officials who willingly give up a chance at more power.
Yeah.
some context here. We're in year five of the emergency declaration on homelessness. It was 2 years
ago. The start of year five.
It was almost 2 years ago, spring of 2018, when the employee head tax, one of the main talking points by its opponents was, we shouldn't be going ahead with this. We should be deferring to some sort of a regional approach. And so this is going to take 2 years from that debate in order to implement, because this new institution won't really be up and running until spring, I wouldn't think.
At the soonest, yeah.
And there's no evidence that they'll actually help the homelessness crisis. But, anything to delay real solutions, anything to delay putting large amounts of affordable housing into the pipeline. And one wonders whether, Choma Sawant has already said that with the new council, she plans to reintroduce some sort of a legislation similar to the head tax. And with that talking point should be gone during that debate. We'll see if that makes any difference or if they just latch onto something else.
Yeah.
All right. So they're having the full council vote is on
Monday.
Yeah. And I know some people on social media are encouraging people to show up for that, that they are not happy about the developments that are occurring here. So,
yeah, show up. If the council takes public testimony.
Like service providers, like the homeless themselves, people like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And their advocates.
Yeah.
All right.
And you can go to, as I've said in the past, you can read the plan for the new regional agency. Just go to the Seattle City Council website, click on the tab for committee or the link for committees. And on the committee page, they have this nice link kind of in the middle of the page saying for a list of the committees and their agendas, click here. That's where you want to go. You'll see a list of, it looks kind of like just a list of data there. On the left will be links to the various committees. What you're looking for is a special committee on homelessness and housing affordability. And if you click on the agenda there or the materials that go along with that committee, you'll be able to see a copy of the regional authority plan that the committee just approved, plus the ordinance, and you can read those documents.
All right, moving on, some developments this week with traffic safety.
Let's talk about the news on tenants' rights first.
Okay.
That was also on my list, too. The Seattle Renters Commission, which is an advisory committee within the Seattle Department of Neighborhoods that gives the mayor and city council advice on tenants' issues, sent a letter to the city council in early November. In that letter, they asked the city council to pass a moratorium on evictions in the city of Seattle from November 1st through March 31st. They noted that wintertime weather places extreme stress on the homelessness, on the homeless, and, quote, an eviction notice can be a death sentence, end quote. That's a direct quote from their letter, especially when it comes to wintertime. The Seattle Renters Commission is made up of 15 individuals, six of whom are appointed by the city council and six appointed by the mayor of Seattle. Then those 12 members appoint an additional two members, and one final member joins through a youth program with the YMCA. Some of the Renters Commission recent advisory opinions have included letters urging the city to pass the mandatory housing affordability upzones, supporting just cause eviction protections, pushing for the law to expand accessory dwelling units in Seattle, and giving advice on which budget items to support that are renter friendly. So they're really not a bunch of wild-eyed commies like some of the business community are saying, but the only city council member to take up their suggestion and to introduce a bill was Choma Sawant. This week, she introduced a bill to prohibit residential landlords from evicting tenants between November 1st and March 31st.
Note that bill does not absolve the renters of their need to pay any back dues or any back rent.
Yeah.
Back rent, yeah.
Now, Sawant based her ordinance on a similar law in Paris, France, that was cited by the Seattle Renters Commission in their letter. Originally, Sawant had hoped to have the full city council vote on the bill this coming Monday, but because of feedback from other council members who want to put the brakes on that, and feedback from the city attorney's office, which is looking into the legal ramifications of it, she said that the bill may need to go through a committee first and get amendments, be debated, have the city council members take some time to look at the pros and cons and the legal issues.
And public hearing.
Yeah. And that would push it out to at least January. So it probably would not, even if it passes, it probably would not apply this year, this winter. The main objections, of course, are the length of time, 5 months, in which a landlord must allow a non-paying renter to stay in the unit. Now, for smaller landlords, that could be a significant financial burden. For larger landlords, less so.
Although the landlords could take the initiative and try to find other housing for them.
Yeah, they could help them try to find other housing.
Yes, but that probably wouldn't occur.
And the city could set up a fund to make loans to smaller landlords to tide them through until they're able to eventually collect and then pay back on that loan.
I suspect that will be an amendment that will be introduced.
Yeah. Also this week, The Stranger ran a series of articles on rent control written by Rich Smith, and I think they are worth reading. Now, remember, in late September, Shama Sawant introduced a rent control bill in city council, and that was just before the council got swamped with the annual budget negotiations, so the bill really didn't go anywhere, and it's still in her committee. Now, Smith interviewed several of the incoming council members to get a sense for how much support that bill will have next year when it's taken up and debated. He concluded that 6 council members might support some form of rent control or prohibition against rent gouging. That includes Shama Sawant, of course, Tammy Morales, Lisa Herbold, who has worked for a long time on rent stabilization issues, Andrew Lewis, Teresa Mosqueda, and Lorena Gonzalez. Deborah Juarez is a maybe. Dan Strauss thinks it's a long shot that really isn't worth spending time on. And Alex Peterson is a straight up no, for those who thought that he might be tenant friendly.
I don't trust Deborah Juarez's response either.
As maybe. Yeah, I know. Neither do I. Now, not all 6 of those council members necessarily support Sawant's bill as is. And even if they did, rent control is still banned in the state of Washington until the state legislature repeals that ban. In fact, Sawant's bill is a trigger law that, if passed, would only go into effect if the state legislature repeals its ban on rent control or a court decision overturns it.
And I know the Sawant people are thinking that if some form of the bill does pass, the next step will be to really pressure the state legislature.
Yeah, to change its ban. So there are a lot of ifs in there and some very big barriers for any rent stabilization law to clear before it can have an effect on the Seattle housing market. So you should not believe the apocalyptic rants that you may be hearing from the business community, from certain real estate developers and some landlords. And I suggest that you check out the Stranger series, in which Smith points out that most landlords and developers use a 3% per year rent increase as the basis for their 15 to 20 year budgets and development models. Now, and I think I've pointed out in the past too that I've been living in, that I tend to live in the same apartment for long periods of time. I looked at my history of rental increases and I have not had a year in the last 10 years where my rent has increased when I've lived in the same unit for a long period of time where my rent has increased more than 4% a year, many years where it doesn't increase at all. So I think the idea of rent stabilization is a really good one, especially when the bill will include exceptions for major repairs and for disasters when a building suffers huge water damage, for example, or a weather event that does big damage to a building. And Sawant's bill does include that mechanism in there to appeal the cap and to provide exemptions for major repairs.
All right. Did you want to touch on the traffic issue or move to clean air?
Yeah, no, let's touch on the traffic issue. This week, the Seattle Department of Transportation released statistics that showed pedestrian fatalities in 2019 in Seattle have tripled since last year. Clearly, the city is not meeting its goals in the city's Vision Zero plan to prevent traffic fatalities. So SDOT head Sam Zimbabwe and Mayor Jenny Durkin announced a few proposals this week. One of them is that all major arterials in the city of Seattle will see their speed limits lowered to 25 miles per hour from 35 to 45 miles per hour in some areas. 2 streets will be exempted because they're state roads, not city roads. That's Aurora Avenue North and Lake City Way. That's actually the full length of Aurora and Lake City Way. But the city is going to work with WashDOT, that's the Washington Department of Transportation, to make safety improvements on those 2 roads, as well as spend $20 million in next year's budget for safety improvements on MLK Way, Rainier Avenue South, Bourne Avenue, and Highland Way.
You know, they could just ban cars entirely, and that would probably reduce pedestrian fatalities even more.
It certainly would. Or ban cell phone use in cars. Yeah.
Or they could, make sure that there's accommodations for pedestrians with the many construction projects around the city that force pedestrians to reroute
on sort of temporary sidewalks with little temporary barriers that are actually on the street. Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to know how many of those fatalities were in that situation.
Or how many of them involve people crossing mid-block because they see a sidewalk-blocked sign ahead of them.
Yeah, and the other thing is that, you know, SDOT has been pushing for years for what it calls traffic calming, which is the idea that getting cars to slow down, et cetera. And that certainly has safety benefits in a city that frequently experiences gridlock with its automobile traffic. Slowing people down, I don't think, is necessarily going to help that at all.
Yeah. Of course, one improvement I think that they announced that I think is a really good one is, and that may really help pedestrian safety, is doubling the number of traffic lights that give pedestrians a walk signal a few seconds before drivers get a green light so that pedestrians get a head start. They get out into the middle of the street and they're not run over by drivers in a hurry to take a right turn or a left turn.
And I saw that a lot living downtown the past few years, where a lot of people in the low income buildings along First Avenue and Second Avenue are disabled. They're in wheelchairs or they're canes or whatever, and it takes them a long time to cross a wide street, and the walk signs just don't accommodate that.
Yeah,
currently.
That is not necessarily one of the plans that's not one of the plans that the mayor and that the head of SDOT announced, and it should be allowing more time for people to get across the street for pedestrians. And I live in a neighborhood, Lower Queen Anne, where the redevelopment of Mercer Street put in these signals that really disadvantage pedestrians and don't give you nearly enough time to get across the street. And I've seen and helped elderly people and disabled people try to get across the street before the traffic light changes on them, and it's just kind of a nightmare.
Yeah,
and it varies widely across the city.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
it does.
Sometimes they give you enough time, and the other streets that are very busy, that's like, nope, you've got
you have 3 seconds to cross this 6-lane street.
Yeah,
yeah, or you have 13 seconds to cross a 6-lane street, and you're walking very slowly because you're disabled and you're using a walker, and you just can't get a little more than halfway across before the light changes on you.
Yep.
All right, anything else on that?
Nope.
All right, did you want to touch on...
Yeah, let's talk about the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency issuing a permit for the Tacoma Liquefied Natural Gas Plant. In spite of comments from environmentalists, activists, local communities, and native tribes, particularly the Puyallup tribe, the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency decided this week to grant the final construction permit to Puget Sound Energy for their new liquefied natural gas facility at the Port of Tacoma. Now, the main source of liquefied natural gas is from fracking, or hydraulic fracturing. That's an extraction technology that can pollute groundwater in surrounding communities, and it releases large amounts of methane into the atmosphere, exacerbating global warming. I just want to remind people that methane is 30 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. Now, in spite of its global warming impact, the Port of Tacoma supports the new facility, saying it will provide a cleaner fuel for marine shipping companies and nearby city residents. But because of the greenhouse gas profile of liquefied natural gas, it is not a cleaner fuel necessarily than diesel fuel.
You know, when the planet is no longer habitable, I'm sure that the advantage to maritime industries is not going to be a factor.
Yeah. Now, in 2016, Puget Sound Energy began illegally building that plant, even though they hadn't received their construction permits. And the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency had issued a violation to them for that purpose. Now, the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency is turning around and saying, well, it's okay. Go ahead.
And how much exactly were they fined?
I don't recall.
That violation? Probably not very much.
I don't recall, and I don't think it was very much, if anything. Now, the permit issued this week by the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency gives Puget Sound Energy the permission to build a plant that as I said, they'd already built illegally, but it was a very craven decision by the agency, which literally ignored its duty to regulate greenhouse gas emissions as part of its mandate to regulate air pollution in Puget Sound. The Puyallup Tribal Council, environmental groups, and others who have been opposing the plant and demonstrating against the plant are appealing this decision to the Washington State Pollution Control Hearings Board in Olympia. That's the next step. Now, I also want to point out, too, that when Governor Jay Inslee was running for president, he said back in May that when he was the climate change candidate, he spoke out against Puget Sound Energy's liquefied natural gas plant. So the question is, where is he now on this, and why has he not said anything recently? It would be nice for folks to give his office a call and demand that he make at least some kind of statement and move to try to block the liquefied natural gas.
Now that he's running for re-election next year.
Yeah, as governor of Washington State.
All right, moving on, a couple banking associations weighing in on with our legislature.
Yeah, and those banking associations represent the 20 largest banking institutions in terms of business done in Washington State. None of them are actually based in Washington State, of course. But this happened a couple weeks ago, but it didn't really get any media attention, and it should have. These banking associations are suing the State Department of Revenue over a tax measure passed at the last minute in the 2019 legislature. HB 2167 increased the business and occupation tax for financial institutions with an annual net income of at least $1 billion. The thing about this is what they're suing about is the long-time practice of leadership of both houses in both parties getting around the need to hold public hearings and give due notice by filing bills that don't actually have any content. They're just shells. And then they insert the language at the very last moment, often with only a day or two left in the legislature. So if this lawsuit succeeds, because this law that they're appealing was approved in that manner last year or this year, it's going to affect a lot more than that, because a lot of the tax measures in particular and regulatory measures and other measures that would attract a lot of lobbying opposition are handled in this way in Olympia. And what the banking associations are contending, and I think they've got a good case, is that that's unconstitutional. It violates the due notice procedure, you know, requirements and all the rest of that. So this can really change the way that the leadership in Olympia and the legislature handle controversial bills or bills that offend people with a lot of money to hire lobbyists and lawyers. We'll see how it goes, but I'll keep a watch on that.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then finally, locally this week, WashDOT was...
Thurston County jury awarded WashDOT $57.2 million in damages after a two-month trial in the delays in the downtown Seattle Highway 99 tunnel project when Bertha broke down in, I believe it was 2016. Of course, that cost WashDOT an awful lot of money. And, everybody was suing everybody over that. The manufacturer of Bertha was involved in lawsuits, the state, WashDOT, the insurance companies that handled the project, they're all suing each other, basically. And this is the first of those trials to actually have an outcome where the WashDOT is getting rewarded the $57 million as compensation for its additional costs in the tunnel project because of the breakdown. There's probably going to be more lawsuits, and there'll probably be more awards, and we'll see if they all cancel each other out or what.
So that was when Bertha basically hit that pipe that was buried.
And then they had to do this huge project of digging a parallel tunnel so they could actually get at Bertha. Rescue Bertha, remove the drilling head.
The drilling head, and they had to ship a new one from Japan.
Yeah. Who could have predicted that? That they would hit unknown items down there.
All right, let's move on to the impeachment news this week.
Oh, nothing really happened. I had the great fortune, and I use that term loosely, to watch the House Judiciary Committee hearings on Tuesday and Thursday, where they were debating articles of impeachment, which of course they voted out yesterday morning. So the full House will consider them next week, and these hearings were interminable. Largely because Republicans engaged in as many stalling tactics as they could and in as many bad faith arguments as they could, things that were demonstrably untrue. And, you know, so many of them that the Democrats on the other side of the committee often didn't try to address them, because I don't know why they didn't.
The Democrats were clearly on a timeline, and
they were on a timeline.
Republicans were clearly trying to stall, in spite of the fact that Donald Trump had tweeted to the Democrats, "Hurry up and finish your articles of impeachment. I want to get on to the trial in the Senate."
Yeah, I'm sure he does, because you know the trial in the Senate will be controlled by Mitch McConnell and Chief Justice John Roberts, who will preside, and that will probably involve the Republicans wanting to call a lot of witnesses that might support some of their different conspiracy theories, particularly around Ukraine being the problem in the 2016 elections, which is, you know, basically a Russian intelligence idea that got currency through Paul Manafort and then Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, and I'm kind of interested to see if they're going to call Rudy Giuliani himself to testify, because he has a tendency to kind of go off topic and say things that are embarrassing and that don't follow the argument that Republicans are trying to make.
Or that just, you know, blurt out what actually happened.
Yeah, exactly.
He of course, he loves the limelight. If I were the Republicans, I would not call him. But, for instance, they want to call Adam Schiff to find out the logistics around the whistleblower contacting him, the original whistleblower that made this public.
They should call Devin Nunes, who actually had phone calls with some of the key players.
Yes.
In the Ukraine shakedown.
One of the many bad faith arguments the Republicans are making, of course, is that this is all the whistleblower's fault, and we need to take a close look at who this is and who they talk to. That was the original mechanism by which word of this conspiracy leaked out, but it was certainly not. Much of what he alleged was backed up by a number of witnesses in the House Intelligence Committee.
Oh, yeah,
in the House Judiciary Committee. So at this point, the whistleblower is pretty much moot. You know, all of the things that he alleged have now been backed up by multiple witnesses. And, you know, the Republicans, most of their arguments are around process and are around things like, how can you impeach Donald Trump? He's been so great for the economy. They actually were saying things like that, which is, you know, deeply irrelevant to the case at hand. But they can't really argue the facts, because the facts are not in dispute. If there were any exculpatory evidence that they had, or even any evidence that cast into doubt some of the evidence that the Democrats had, they would be using it, and they're not, because they can't talk about it, because there's nothing there. So we'll see whether the Senate impeachment trial is actually a serious trial, or whether it's just the Republicans trying to score talking points ahead of the election.
Yeah. Now, the two articles of impeachment are abuse of power and obstruction of Congress.
Yes.
And they didn't include any articles that related to the Russia investigation or the Mueller report.
No. Or any of
witness tampering.
Any of the other potential issues they could have included, like emoluments and some of the other things where Donald Trump has clearly been abusing his power. They could have even, you know, elucidated those under abuse of power as part of that article. But they really wanted to keep a narrow focus on the Ukraine case, because
they have the witnesses and the evidence.
They felt that was the strongest case.
Yeah.
Now, the Republicans are saying, well, you don't have the players, the people who are actually committing these things, testifying, except for Sondland, of course. But the reason for that, of course, is the obstruction of Congress, the Trump administration has ignored. I believe the count is now 71 different subpoenas for people to appear, and thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of documents that the Intelligence Committee and Investigation wanted to hand it over. A lot of those would likely not help Donald Trump's case in particular. It would be very interesting to know what's in that secret server. What other conversations that Trump had with foreign leaders that were buried in that vault? And we know what a few of those conversations were, if not the content. And certainly all of his conversations with Vladimir Putin have gone there. And since the entire Ukrainian conspiracy seems to have been designed not just to help Trump, but also to help Russia in terms of in terms of its effort to gain influence in Ukraine and gain territory and prosecuting that war, let alone the withholding of the $391,000 in military aid.
Yeah. So $391 million.
Million, yes.
Now, one of the things that I find kind of interesting is we do know that Trump has financial connections to Russia. And this week, the Supreme Court agreed to hear cases that would determine whether or not banks would be required to release documents in the various lawsuits against Trump.
And not just the lawsuits, but also criminal investigations.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Because there are criminal investigations into Trump, a lot of them stemming from Michael Cohen. Remember Michael Cohen? That was so long ago.
Yeah.
His testimony under oath before Congress that Trump routinely cheated on his taxes and his insurance claims. And this is something that the Southern District of New York and the state of New York
And his loan applications.
Yes, are very interested in pursuing. Mm-hmm. But they haven't been able to do it because they haven't been able to get a hold of his tax returns.
Yeah. So that's one of the cases that the Supreme Court agreed this week that they would hear. They're likely to hear those in March is what the current timeline looks like. And then, of course, they will issue decisions by the end of June, which is when their term is up.
Right.
Just
before the nominating convention.
That'll be right in smack in the middle of the election next year. That'll be very interesting to follow.
Yeah, it will.
When he'll promise once again to show everyone his tax returns.
No,
I don't think he's ever promised that.
No, I think he's promised not to.
I thought he actually did in the 2016 that he said he would show his tax returns.
Oh, well, he said a lot of things in 2016 that he didn't mean.
He says a lot of things that don't mean anything.
Yes. Well, that part's clear, but I'm just saying it's like if it worked back then, it's always good to bring it back one more time.
Well, and that's certainly the heart of the Ukraine conspiracy also. He got foreign assistance in his election in 2016 and got away with it, so why not go ahead and do it in 2020 also? And that's one of the cases the Democrats are making for their expedited timeline is that you know, the Ukraine conspiracy is not just a crime that happened in the past. It's ongoing. Rudy Giuliani was in the Ukraine this past week, and still trying to dig up people who will go along with his claim that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election and Russia was blameless, et cetera, et cetera, and trying to get people to investigate the Bidens. So that's still happening. It's not like Trump has shut that down because of the inconvenience with the impeachment and everything.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, speaking of reruns, this week there's some developments with NAFTA 2.0.
Yeah, the mainstream Democrats announced that they had struck a deal with Trump on the North American Trade Pact, the revised United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, now known as USMCA. Is what will replace NAFTA. Nancy Pelosi et al., they announced that they had won concessions that make it, quote, infinitely better than what was initially proposed by the administration, end quote. Notice she didn't say it was infinitely better than NAFTA. Now, the main concessions are these. It will remove some intellectual property protections for pharmaceuticals while increasing them for the biotech industry, for financial services, and the tech industry. So you could argue that the trade-off there wasn't really worth it. It eliminates language that ensured an extension of patent protections when a drug company finds a new use for an existing drug, a 3-year extension for patent protections, which you could also argue is a minor change. It requires that Mexico pass laws to make it easier for workers to unionize with no, as far as I can tell, no detail about what those laws must be.
Or enforcement mechanism.
Yeah. It adds additional oversight to ensure that Mexico is complying with labor reforms. But again, the enforcement mechanism doesn't seem to be particularly strong. It allows the U.S. to block goods from specific Mexican factories that violate labor laws. That's the one thing. But it doesn't ensure that that will happen. It requires that at least 30% of work done to make automobiles in U.S., Canada, or Mexico must be done by workers making at least $16 per hour. Now, that's three times what Mexican auto workers currently make, but there's no guarantee that that 30% will be manufactured in Mexico. If, for example, 70% of an automobile is made there, the other 30% could be made in the USA or Canada. Environmental protections are there. There is at least one type of environmental protection in the bill for marine wildlife to protect them from pollution and overfishing by all three countries. That's just one environmental protection that they were talking about that's in the bill. I didn't see a whole lot of others in there. And after 3 years, it removes most of Chapter 11, which allowed big corporations to challenge governmental laws in any of the three countries through an arbitration process that's separate from those countries' national court systems. That's an abuse that activists have opposed for a long time. That's mostly gone, except, and this is the big exception, except for the oil industry, which lobbied hard to keep that Chapter 11 protection in place with Mexico in case Mexico tries to renationalize its energy sector. So aside from those changes, about 90% of the USMCA is just NAFTA 2.0 without any changes.
And I was really struck looking at that agreement. I was fairly involved in the 20th anniversary celebrations of the World Trade Organization protests in 1999, and the WTO itself was founded in 1995 as a direct consequence of the U.S. government and the Clinton administration's enthusiasm for multilateral trade deals.
Yeah, right.
And that was based on NAFTA.
NAFTA in 1994.
And a lot of the oppositions to NAFTA, if you go back to the early 90s and look at that debate, the opponents were right. It did cost jobs in all three countries.
Mm-hmm.
It did worsen environmental protections. It did worsen labor standards. And one of the big schisms in the WTO protests was between organized labor, which just wanted, quote, a seat at the table, and the people who blockaded downtown who wanted the whole structure torn down. And it strikes me that once again we're talking about adding a few labor protections, maybe adding an environmental protection here and there, with no evidence that those will be successfully implemented, because it certainly wasn't with NAFTA.
Yeah, and Nancy Pelosi announced the agreement right after the AFL-CIO president announced that he was fine with the changes to the new. So again, it's, you know, mainstream labor basically saying, okay, we get a few changes in there, we're good with it.
Yeah, business unionism at its finest.
Yeah.
So I'm deeply skeptical of this new agreement, but of course Trump will cite it as a promise kept in his reelection campaign, and that was the whole point.
Yeah.
So the question is, why did the Democrats go along then?
Well, I think the Democrats went along, and they went along with a lot of things this week because they wanted to appear, particularly the Democrats in the House, they wanted to appear to be getting something done in addition to the impeachment hearings.
Yeah, and they wanted to demonstrate that they were willing to work across the aisle, and therefore Republicans should be willing to join them in the impeachment effort, which is kind of a fool's errand. But
yes, I think it's definitely a fool's errand.
Yeah, it's never worked for them in the past.
Yeah.
What is that? That's a saying about repeating something that
it's part of the we take the high road idea rather than the we're realists and we're going to do what we can get done.
Yeah.
Is that what that guy that's pushing that rock up the hill says? I'm taking the high road?
Pretty much. Yeah, it's basically bringing a butter knife to a gunfight.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see once again mainstream media pundits saying the Democrats really need to become more, and Joe Biden this week also, saying that the Democrats need to become more moderate to appeal to centrists who aren't being served by the Republicans right now. You know, we hear that every 4 years about the Democratic Party.
And the Democratic Party moves further and further to the right. It does.
Well, and with the military budget, they did
that,
as well.
Yeah, we saw that this week with the House passing the $738 billion military bill that gave Donald Trump pretty much everything he wanted, except for the wall. But even there, the Democrats didn't hold firm because the bill doesn't contain any language that prevents Donald Trump from shifting funds again from other military projects into building his wall.
Oops.
Yeah, oops. Other language that got dropped would includes a requirement that the military clean up hazardous chemicals known as PFAs. That was dropped. Language that would have banned new detainees at Guantanamo Bay. That was cut out. A clause that would have cut certain types of weapons sales to Saudi Arabia was also dropped. So we'll continue.
Even though Congress has been circumvented by the Trump administration and its Saudi Arabia arms deals.
Yeah, so the support for Saudi Arabia's continuous bombing campaign in Yemen will continue. Language that would have required Trump to seek congressional approval for a war against Iran, that was cut out. And the bill includes Donald Trump's pet project to create a space force as the sixth branch of the U.S. military.
Good Lord.
Let's militarize space, in other words.
Well, space has already been militarized by the U.S. The U.S. Space Command's been doing that for 20 years.
Yeah. Now, it also includes Ivanka Trump's pet project of providing 12 weeks of paid parental leave to civilian federal employees, which really has no business being in the military funding bill. It was just snuck in there as added pork by her husband, Jared Kushner, who negotiated the bill with Representative Adam Smith. He's a Democrat from Washington State, who's chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. And I want to remind folks that Smith is a classic conservative Democrat, representative of how the party has moved further and further to the right. He's someone who would have fit securely into the center of the Republican Party, I think, a generation ago.
And he represents a district in South King County and Pierce County that is demographically shifting rapidly.
Increasingly becoming a minority district.
Yeah, a much larger immigrant population, et cetera. And he really doesn't represent them the way he did in the past.
For example, he voted in favor of the Patriot Act in 2001. He voted for the invasion of Iraq in 2002. And he's voted multiple times in support of warrantless wiretapping by the federal government. So there are some things about him that should disturb progressive Democrats, but most particularly anyone who considers themselves an old-style Democrat.
Yeah, and there was I forget her name, but there was a progressive who ran against Smith and did a pretty good campaign last year, and so hopefully he'll get an even stronger.
Hopefully he'll get another one. Yeah, he's been in the House for a really long time. It's time to get him out. And there was really nothing that the Democrats could really boast about in the bill. Progressive Democrats in the House all voted against it. Donald Trump, on the other hand, boasted on Twitter, quote, "Wow, all of our priorities have made it into the final NDAA, meaning the National Defense Authorization Act. And he was really correct about that. And that means money for the wall, too. Even though it isn't specifically a line item for the wall, he can easily shuffle money around to continue building it.
Yeah, and shuffling money from the things he likes least, such as efforts by the U.S. and Europe to counteract potential Russian aggression.
Yeah, or providing benefits to veterans who need more health benefits,
yeah,
for example.
Or infrastructure on military bases.
Yeah, or remodeling VA hospitals that need it desperately.
Yeah, a lot of those buildings are very, very old at this point.
Was that Sarah Smith that ran against him?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. That's correct.
So she's still around and kicking.
Good.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. There's also news about the U.S.-China trade deal this week.
Yeah. Trump saved his announcement on this for the same day that the House Judiciary Committee passed the articles of impeachment against him. He had actually announced 2 months ago that he had a deal with China, but then he went quiet about it, saving it, I guess, as the ace in the hole for just this day.
Yeah. For a news day when he needed to insert himself into the news cycle.
Now, this is just the first phase agreement with China, and all it contains is an agreement by China to spend somewhere between $27 billion and maybe $50 billion on U.S. farm goods, with no details given about exactly what they would buy and how much they would actually spend. They have agreed, I guess, to spend up to $200 billion total in purchasing goods That includes manufactured goods as well. No, I guess this is over 2 years, but I'm not super clear about it. But again, they were planning to spend about that much over 2 years anyway on U.S. goods. So this agreement really isn't any increase.
So they didn't really give up anything.
They didn't really give up anything there. It includes vague.
That sounds like a classic Trump deal.
Yeah, it includes vague agreements for China to, quote, tighten intellectual property protections, end quote, and open its financial markets. The only thing I see in there that's solid is that U.S. banks are big winners because they will have now new access to Chinese financial markets. Now, in turn, you know, Trump working on behalf of Wall Street, in turn, the U.S. will not impose tariffs on $160 billion in Chinese tech goods and toys, or tech goods and toys that are being imported from China, a lot of them made by U.S. companies that were set to take effect on December 15th. He will cut in half the 15% tariff imposed on $120 billion in goods from China that were imposed in September. That's mostly clothing and shoes. Again, a lot of it made by U.S. companies. And the 25% tariffs on manufactured goods and parts are going to remain in place still. That means about $370 billion in tariffs are going to stay in place.
So Trump's trade war is still a going thing.
Still a going thing. What it doesn't contain are three of the biggest issues that American businesses were hoping and that Republicans and Donald Trump said that he would definitely be able to get. First off, there's no change in the enormous subsidies that the Chinese government grants to its state-owned enterprises. No change there. No change to the requirement that foreign companies in China must partner with Chinese businesses to get access to the Chinese market and thereby surrendering their technological secrets to their Chinese partners. No change there. No steps to address the U.S.-China trade deficit, which will still exist and be almost as large as usual, even after the agreement has been signed. And I should remind folks that U.S. businesses and consumers have paid at least $88 billion in tariffs over the last 21 months in order to support Donald Trump's trade war with China. Now, industry groups are trying to put a good spin on this agreement with China, but they're having a really tough time. And many of them think that Trump gave up the tariffs that he did too soon just to get some good press to help himself politically.
There's a shock.
And I have to say, wow, doesn't that sound familiar? There's also the issue, too, that Robert Lighthizer, who is Trump's trade representative, he's going to be the guy to sign the deal. And Donald Trump is not planning to introduce this bill at all in Congress. So portions of it may remain secret long after the deal is signed.
That's a little disturbing.
That is very disturbing.
All right. And finally, there was an election this week in the UK that... surprised.
The Tories and Boris Johnson won overwhelmingly. If you look at the actual electoral map of the UK, though, it really underscores what a significant election this was. First of all, areas within the UK, like Wales and the Midlands and Northern England, which traditionally go strongly for Labour, did not this time. And there were a number of reasons for that. The Labour's candidate, Jeremy Corbyn, had stood for prime minister before. He had been around a long time. He had various scandals in his past, very reminiscent of Hillary Clinton in 2016. He was an uninspiring candidate who'd been around for a long time when people wanted change. And for anybody who's been in Seattle for the last decade, we'll relate to this. British voters, just like Seattle voters, with the interminable debates over what to do about the earthquake damage to Alaska Way Viaduct, finally just gave up and voted for a bad outcome just to get it over with. In the case of Seattle voters, they voted for the downtown tunnel, which was being pushed by the business community, and which is by far the most expensive option, just because they were
after,
sick
what was
of
it,
the debate.
Three elections or three votes on the same topic?
Yeah, there was one vote in which three things were... three proposals were given to voters, one for an at-grade solution, one for a new elevated freeway, and one for which was the tunnel, and none of them got a majority, even close to a majority. Mm-hmm. It was basically one-third each. And, you know, if you want to go even farther back, it's also reminiscent of stadium deals, which were voted on again and again until
voters agreed to do what state politicians and businesses wanted.
Well, in that case, it went to the state legislature in terms of the Mariners deal, and Paul Allen financed a statewide initiative in terms of the Seahawks stadium, which of course took it outside of King County to all the Seahawks fans in Eastern Washington, and they were happy to vote yes and let Seattle pick up the tab. Mm-hmm. But in the case of British voters, they're exhausted by the Brexit and the seemingly inability of the British government to come up with any kind of solution. And what Johnson was offering was a solution. It may be a terrible solution, but it is a solution. And so it looks like very likely that early in the new year, the UK will move out of the EU. Now, the other thing that was interesting about the vote was that Scotland and Northern Ireland voted for parties that are advocating leaving the UK. The Scottish National Party won overwhelmingly in Scotland, and they're promising a second referendum after one in 2014 that failed narrowly on Scottish independence. Scotland wants to stay in the EU. And in the case of Northern Ireland, they don't want to have potentially a hard border down the road again with Ireland. And there's a lot of push for Irish reunification. So this vote may not just have put Johnson in power for another 5 years. It may also have signaled pretty much the end of the British Empire, as even the British Isles will start peeling away from England and Wales.
So can we talk a little bit, too, about the EU agreement on carbon neutrality?
Yes.
Very quickly.
Yeah. This week, as part of the COP25 Global Climate Summit in Madrid, Spain, the European Union agreed to 50% reductions in carbon emissions by the year 2030 and for the European Union to go carbon neutral by the year 2050. There's some elements of this agreement that are not so great. One is that Poland is not included because Poland heavily relies on coal, although the negotiators for the European Union said that they will revisit that next year. And that also as part of the agreement, they agreed that it was okay to shift to nuclear power in order to reach that goal. And that was a concession to the Czech Republic and to Hungary, who are both highly reliant on nuclear power. It specifies, in other words, the right of member states to make their own decisions was a key part of this agreement. But also as part of the agreement, the European Investment Bank will provide $1 trillion or 1 trillion euros to help member states reach the goal.
And meanwhile, in the U.S., Trump is doing everything possible to underwrite and expand fossil fuel extraction.
Yeah. And in the meantime, the COP25 summit has not been seen as a success because the two main goals of the summit have not been met. First off, there is not been an agreement on funding for small countries most affected by climate change to help them. And there's been no agreement on setting up a carbon market to help nations overall reach the reach neutrality.
And if you think of some of those smaller European states mm-hmm. that are basically at sea level, like the Netherlands and Denmark, mm-hmm. They're going to be heavily affected by climate change.
Well,
and they're
and
wrestling
a lot
with
of,
that now.
A lot of island nations that are already starting to disappear because
yeah, sure.
of small
well,
increases.
Well, in other parts of the world, the only island nation really in Europe is Malta.
I'm talking about the Madrid Climate Summit as a whole, globe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Island nations in the Pacific that are already starting to disappear.
Absolutely.
With the Marshall Islands.
Very modest increases in
Micronesia.
In sea level rise.
All right. Events. Any events?
Monday, December 16th, Climate Science on Tap, Crops, Carbon, and Climate Change. You can go and have a beer and listen to some experts on cutting greenhouse gas emissions in agriculture. That's hosted by Cascadia Climate Action and Carbon Washington from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Optimism Brewing Company at 1158 Broadway on Capitol Hill.
I'm not sure that beer and gas emissions are mutually compatible.
Now, on Tuesday, December 17th, is Impeachment Eve Rally. Seattle says impeach and remove, hosted by Seattle Indivisible and Move On. That's from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Federal Building downtown at 2nd and Marion Street. That's on Tuesday. On Thursday, December 19th, is Puget Sound Clean Air Agency holding a public hearing on adopting a clean fuel standard for transportation. Several environmental groups are planning to attend to push for a strong set of rules. And you might also want to go and ask the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency why they approved the permit for Puget Sound Energy's liquefied natural gas facility in Tacoma, and to remind them that liquefied natural gas is not a clean transportation fuel. There's a rally from 11 a.m. to 11:30. The hearing starts at 12:30 p.m. That's at Washington State Convention Center at 705 Pike Street. There's a second hearing that day, too, starting at 5 p.m. at the same place. The rally is going to be at room 3B and the hearing in room 2AB. So that's on Thursday. And that's it.
All right.
Awesome.
So we'll plan on seeing you both back next week?
Yes, I'll be here.
I'll be here, too.
Yeah, and I think we'll be starting our wrap-up of the most underreported and important stories of 2019.
Yep, it's that time of year again.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to it.
And there's a long list to pick from.
There is a big list.
All right. Check it twice. And you are...
So can we give coal to the people who've been bad, or is that, no good anymore?
That's not PC anymore.
That doesn't work anymore. Sorry, you're going to have to come up with something else.